Part 3. Words, thoughts, actions, and the media. Let's think now of all the ways that these bad thoughts, these negative thoughts, come into your mind and lodge themselves in your long-term memory. Well, the biggest culprit has to be the media. All the people that I've ever met who have a fear of flying have said that their fear has been made worse by the press and by television programs. I could make this the shortest chapter on the course by saying, number one, don't read press reports about air travel and particularly accidents. Number two, don't watch so-called documentaries about air safety. And number three, don't research on the internet for information about airlines, aircraft, or air safety. And that's all there is to it. If you can avoid doing those things and forget anything you've ever read or heard about the dangers of aviation, then you will have made an enormous amount of progress. But of course, I understand that real life is different from theory, and I think it would be unreasonable for you just to accept my word without some more explanation. In fact, there has been a great deal of research into the influences of media information on the fear of flying. For instance, an aircraft accident in Holland some years ago when three crew members were lost was widely reported in the Australian press. The question we must ask is, would the same paper carry a story of three people dying in a car crash on a motorway in Holland? No, of course not. So why the plane accident? Money and sales. No other reason. The effect of this distorted reporting is to persuade us to believe that the more spectacular incidents occur more frequently than the ones with which we're familiar, and in reality, more likely to be involved in. For example, car accidents or illness. It's called the availability heuristic. It's a rule of thumb that we use to assess risk, and we respond to and give greater importance to spectacular events rather than the ones we're more likely to be involved with. Here's another example. Over a period of 12 months, two newspapers reported 528 cases of death caused by homicide and one article involving a death as a result of diabetes. A survey conducted at the same time revealed that the public perception was that death by murder was four times as great than death by diabetes. Death by diabetes is far more likely, of course. It's not unreasonable, then, to assume that newspaper reports influence the way we think about risk. Even worse is the fact that although we may have the statistics available, we are particularly influenced by the style of the reports. Lurid and detailed reports stay in our minds and are available to confirm a natural bias that we have about the dangers of flying. Although this isn't scientific proof, there is a lot of evidence to show that highlighting the dangers associated with air travel, especially for people who already have a fear, is very likely to increase that fear. Let's look at this another way. It's very likely that during my career, I've had more access to reports about aircraft incidents than you've had. And yet, I've never been persuaded that flying is anything other than the safest form of transport available. Because I know the facts, I'm uninfluenced by emotion and any attempt to involve them. Unfortunately, the modern trend of news broadcasting and media coverage is geared to the emotive, spectacular, and sensational. The subject of air travel is a perfect subject for a journalist short of a story or headline. We know that a fear of flying can be developed by a child because of the attitude and behaviour of the parents. And so this learning by example can be extended to susceptible people who read reports about aircraft and aviation. So far, I've confined my comments to newspapers who have just headlines and still pictures to send their messages. How much more powerful, then, are the moving visual images that we get on television? I've never had an interest in air disaster programs or the inside stories of what really happened, but in recent years I've been asked about them. As a result, I've tried to watch a number which have been available on satellite television. I have to say that it has been very difficult to watch such programs for any longer than a few minutes. The depiction of how a pilot flies an aeroplane is so far from the truth as to be laughable. Pilots hanging onto the controls in the style of a Hollywood movie are simply untrue. Quite often, the so-called technical facts are highly questionable and, for the most part, utterly unreliable. There are a number of retired accident investigators who make a living by appearing on these programs. I'm very doubtful that they conducted their accident investigations with the same sensationalist style that they use when appearing on television. Perhaps I do them an injustice and should reserve my criticism for the editors of the programmes, but whatever the reason, the facts take second place to ratings. The reporting of an incident at Heathrow some while ago was so distorted as to be comic. A television reporter referred to accident investigators as the men in white coats, suggesting there was some extra mystery, some unfathomable fact that only they could discover. The reporter then tried to link one technical feature of the aeroplane with a quite different one. Clearly, she had no understanding of the relationship between how an aeroplane is controlled and its engines. And yet, she pursued this line of pointless questioning for at least half the interview. The whole report was misleading, ill-informed, and highly inaccurate, and yet was broadcast around the world. I'm sure that you have an area of expertise that is often reported in the newspapers, and I can only ask you to compare what you know about your subject and the way that it's reported, and use that as the basis for interpreting media reports. Much better than wasting your time doing that, just ignore them. Never ever be tempted by them. Never ever believe that they will enlighten you. Never ever believe what they say. I'm sure you can tell that I'm no fan of the media, but why should I be when they do so much harm to vulnerable people? There's a link between what I've just been saying and what we shall talk about next. We've been talking about media reporting. Reporting uses words, and the type of reporting we've been talking about uses sensational words. And, as if by some strange coincidence, they're the sort of words that people who have a fear of flying tend to use. This is not unreasonable. We would hardly expect people who are anxious about flying to use the sort of terminology or vocabulary that I, as a pilot, would use. Why should they? They have neither the knowledge nor the need. Or at least they haven't had the need until now. As I said earlier, I never learned to plummet, neither did I ever learn to strain the engines on takeoff. I certainly didn't learn to fly through thunderstorms or to bank too steeply. In fact, there's hardly a thing that I learned to do that a fearful flyer has experienced. Yet many things that I didn't learn seem to happen all the time to anxious flyers. So somewhere there's a big misunderstanding. Before we change those misunderstandings into facts, let's have a few thoughts about words. There's a psychological school which believes that we see the world in the way that we describe it. In other words, if a person described a town as modern, with libraries, restaurants, and good car parking facilities, they would tend, and it is only a tendency, to see life as things. Someone else may describe the same town by the people who inhabit it and the cultural activities that happen there. They would tend, and I emphasize the word tend, to see the world through what people do. There are other ways, of course. Some people see life through pictures, emotions, sounds, and so on. Quite often, life coaches and personal trainers will encourage us to change our view of what we see, such as making an obstacle into an opportunity by using positive words and thoughts rather than using negative ones. For example, to see the fact that we've lost our job as an opportunity to find a better one. Where some people will see a hill as an obstruction to a view, others might see it as giving you a better view. All pretty obvious stuff, really, but what has this to do with flying or the fear of flying? I expect that if you and I were in conversation, we'd use very different viewpoints and words to describe the same thing. You are more likely to be emotive and inaccurate, whereas I am more likely to be unemotional and highly factual. Not only is this the result of my training as a pilot, it's also the way things really are. When I prepare to take off, the co-pilot and I go through the checklist. That's a fact. You're more likely to see that as an opportunity for me to forget something. When I take off, I set the power of the engines to what I describe as takeoff thrust. You would describe the sounds as the engine straining. When I raise the nose to the correct liftoff attitude, you would probably describe it as the nose pointing up too far, and so on. Words and the way we use them reflect what we feel. But unfortunately, they also reinforce our thoughts, feelings, and the way we behave. Regarding the use of words, what about this as an example? If we wanted to frighten a child who had never flown, which description, yours or mine, would be more likely to do that? Furthermore, if it's likely to frighten a child, then surely it must have some influence on your feelings. I've had many conversations with people who have a fear of flying, as you might expect. On first meeting them, I ask them to describe how they feel about flying, and their descriptions are full of words that I would never dream of using because they're emotional and they're inaccurate. In other words, they don't reflect what really happens. Overcoming your fear will depend upon being able to challenge your thoughts and beliefs. One of the ways to reinforce and strengthen that process is to write things down. It may seem a simple and therefore unnecessary thing to do, but it has many benefits. I won't explain them, but please take my word for it. Perhaps you should now take a short break from this course and sit quietly and describe to yourself the various things that you've experienced that have made you as fearful as you are. And yes, it will be worth writing them down. Look at how you describe things and see how many emotive words there are compared with facts, and I'm sure you'll find there's an imbalance. But all this is very easy for me to say because I know the facts and they've been part of my life for 45 years. If I were asked to describe other jobs, I wouldn't be able to use the correct language, and certainly, if I were anxious about it, I'd probably use emotive language. The thought of being in a submarine is not a pleasant one for me, and I should probably describe not liking the feeling of being surrounded by water. But I'm sure an experienced submariner would smile and say, "You're not surrounded by water. You're surrounded by a very strong, well-designed metal hull." And immediately, it would change my perception of things. So I hope that some of the things that I've said already will begin to build your confidence. Let's review what we've done so far. We started by looking at the kinds of behaviours that people who have a fear of flying tend to display. We've looked at the way we store information in our long-term memory, and we've looked at one of the principal reasons, that is to say the media, for feeding our fears. We've briefly considered the effects of words that we use to describe what we feel. So now it's time to move on to a more practical way of using these theories. But first, I'll leave you to have a think. Part 4. Some ideas from the psychologists. Earlier I said that there is a psychological school of thought that suggests that we see the world in the way that we describe it. This process is called NLP, which stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. NLP is not as simple as I previously described it. It has many elements, some of which are valuable in trying to overcome the fear of flying. If you think this form of therapy could help you, there are many books available about it. It's sufficient for our purposes to describe simply a couple of its main suggestions. If the words we use to describe the situation cause us anxiety, then we should change the way we describe things. This will help us to put a more rational explanation on the things that we fear. Once again, I'll use the example of plummeting rather than the correct word, which is descending. The more you can describe things to yourself in unemotional language, the more confidence you'll build within yourself. There is another interesting theory in NLP. It is suggested that you should take the fearful situation and change the image in your mind from the big colour version that you see into a black and white version, and then gradually reduce the size of that image until it becomes very small and unrecognisable. The more you practice this technique, the more you will gain from it. There are variations on this theme, one of which is to see yourself in a strong position rather than the weak one that you perceive yourself to be in. I'm not fully familiar with how these techniques should be applied, but I understand that during this process, as the pictures change, you say swish, so that in future, when you say the words, you associate them with change. These techniques and practices restructure events rather than thoughts. I don't have strong feelings about its effectiveness. If it works and works on a long-term basis, then I'm in favour. But it's not a subject that I know enough about to say any more than that. Sometimes therapies are associated with tapping parts of the body, and whether this just distracts your mind or whether it really does connect with a meridian in the body, I can't be sure. but the fact is that these techniques work for some people. While we're on the subject of images, there is a strong case for another simple form of visualization. Can you think of somewhere that brings you peace of mind? Somewhere that perhaps is very special to you? Perhaps something that reminds you of a happy or peaceful time in your life. If you can recall that image and then are able to close your eyes and imagine yourself to be there, this can be a very powerful technique in controlling your stress levels. I'm most definitely in favour of this because it's verifiable and simple. You're anxious, you think of somewhere special, and you calm down. It's got to be good, hasn't it? As I said at the very beginning, I'm not going to include anything that isn't directly related to overcoming your fear, so I'll leave you to investigate these methods to see if they work for you. Another form of therapy is called CBT, which, as I'm sure you know, stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. CBT is the process which traces thoughts, emotions, and behaviours. CBT suggests that what we think causes emotions, and it is the emotions which cause our behaviour. I'm more persuaded by this therapy than any other because it is observably true. Here's an example of why I think it's a realistic and effective method. When we're young, we know that the process of meeting a partner is an exciting time. Usually our minds are full of happy and confident thoughts, and, as a result, the emotions we display are good humour, tolerance, and sympathy. We know the other side of the coin as well. Most of us can remember the sadness at the end of a relationship. Perhaps we think of losing a loved one to someone else. We know that whatever we think cannot change the outcome. We're sad because of the thoughts that we're having. Those thoughts would certainly stop us being the life and soul of the party. Rather, we'd tend to be quiet. We'd probably lose our appetite and be generally unfriendly. The future would look bleak, and we'd find it painful to socialise. Indeed, this is exactly what happens. Our thoughts drive our emotions, and then our behaviour. I can't think of a clearer example of thoughts causing emotions that result in a particular behaviour. If, therefore, we have negative thoughts about flying, it will lead to behaviour that reflects those thoughts and feelings. When we feel anxious, our heart rate goes up, our muscles tense, our eyes widen, and we become hypervigilant. That's to say, we become very aware of everything that's going on around us. Now, the problem with that is that an anxious flyer will not see these physiological changes as a result of the thoughts. They will believe them to be in addition to the thoughts, and therefore believe the situation to be worse than it really is. A typical thought pattern might be, "I'm not looking forward to this flight because the weather's bad." This will bring on the changes in the body, and then the thoughts go to, "I feel sick. I'm breathing quickly. I'm going to have a panic attack." In fact, these changes do not add to the amount of fear. They're caused by the fear, and if you didn't have one, you wouldn't have the other. If then you can control the thoughts, it's very, very likely that you'll avoid the feeling of sickness, the shallowness of breath, and the thought of an oncoming panic attack. As Hamlet said, there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And there have been many variations of that saying. We know that children can be frightened just by thinking there is someone under their bed or in the cupboard when it comes to bedtime. We know that it's just a thought, but to the child it is reality. Your reality is a thought also. My reality is built on facts. I hope that many of the things that I've said so far are beginning to change your thoughts into my reality. So far then, we've been concentrating on the way we think and some methods for restructuring our thoughts so that they become positive thoughts leading to positive actions. It may take some time before you can completely remove all the negative thoughts that you have in your long-term memory, but one thing we can begin with, starting now, is to stop any more negative thoughts entering your mind. Like many things in overcoming your fear of flying, this is easier said than done, but there are ways, very simple ways, to prevent negative thoughts flooding into your head. One of the things that people tell me is that when they're preparing for a flight, that their negative thoughts start in the night. When they wake, their mind is full of negative thoughts that are impossible to control. Once awake, they lay there with the thoughts going round and round incessantly until they're up and getting on with the day. For some people, it's so bad that they feel physically sick and tired throughout the day. Hardly the state of mind and body to fight off more negative thoughts. And, as I have said before, these feelings sometimes start even before the tickets are bought and become more intense once they're committed to a flight. Weeks and months of anxiety are going to have an effect on your well-being and your resistance levels. Under these circumstances, the best way to start is to allocate a period of the day when you can worry as much as you want to, but to promise yourself that you won't worry at other times. Anxious flyers tell me that about 4 o'clock in the afternoon is the best time, and if you're able to contain your thoughts during the day, you can look forward to the time when you're allowed to worry. When that's done, you can continue practicing avoiding thoughts for the rest of the day. I suggest a period of about 10 minutes when you can sit and enjoy your worries. As you might expect, I don't think this is a good habit to get into if things are really bad for you, but at least this is one way of taking control. Once you have some control, even if it's only about the time when you're allowed to worry, you can begin to take control over your thoughts. Let's talk about those thought-stopping techniques while we're here. There are some very simple methods to stop negative thoughts. One that I've found particularly successful is an elastic band on my wrist, and it works like this. Each time I become aware of a negative thought, I pull the elastic band and let it go so that it pings onto my wrist. You'll probably find this fairly painful too, but if you stick to the rule that if you begin to think about things that worry you, that you have to ping the elastic band, you'll soon find that your negative thoughts will begin to subside. Many psychologists recommend that if these thoughts enter your head, then you raise your hand and say, "Stop." Some people even say, "Stop, I don't need you, go away." Personally, I'd find that difficult in public, so that's why I do the elastic band pinging. There are many methods of thought stopping, and as before, I'll leave you to find the method that's most suitable for you. At the start of this course, I said everything is connected, that nothing was in isolation, and that there wasn't a magic formula to get you flying. But there is one thing that you have to do, and this applies to everyone. You can't miss it out, and there is no way around it. You can make it easier for yourself, but it is the most important part of overcoming your fear. What you will have to do eventually is to face your fear. There will be a day when you take a flight, or book a flight, or go to the airport. Nothing can change that fact. This will mean feeling anxious, but feeling anxious will not harm you. A good way of preparing is to recreate the environment which would cause your anxiety levels to increase. You should do this to discover what it feels like to be anxious, but at the same time to be in control. We've included a small selection of soundtracks where you can imagine being in different stages of a flight. You can do this in the security and comfort of your own home. Don't be upset by feeling anxious. It's a perfectly natural thing to happen. What you need to do is to feel the anxiety and get used to it and become aware of the fact that it has a limit. Understandably, people believe that their anxiety levels will increase to such an extent that they'll be unable to bear it. But this, in fact, is not the case. It's good to get used to those things to get the confidence that you will always be in control. Perhaps while you're listening to the sounds, you should practice your relaxation, breathing, and visualization routines. These may seem like silly or insignificant steps, but they will all go towards helping you to overcome your fear. Nothing will work in isolation, and as I have said, there are many small steps, but each one is vital. Each one strengthens both the next action and the previous one. If you think of your fear of flying as a jigsaw with each piece representing a part of your fear, before the puzzle is made, there are hundreds of pieces, all unconnected and unidentifiable, some upside down, some the wrong way round. There is no sensible order in any of it. But when making the picture, most people start with the border, because every part of the border has a common feature. it has a straight edge. Your straight edges in overcoming your fear of flying are possibly avoiding press reports and unhelpful television programs. The pieces of the jigsaw that have the same color could represent restructuring your thoughts. Those easily recognized faces in a jigsaw puzzle could represent the facts that have replaced the myths and misunderstandings that you previously had about flying, and so on. Like the jigsaw, your picture of overcoming your fear of flying will build slowly at first. As more pieces are laid in position, two things happen that make the completion much easier. Firstly, there are fewer pieces to deal with, and secondly, there are fewer spaces for them to go into. That's like fewer negative thoughts and fewer places to put them. In the same way that a jigsaw works, so can the process of controlling your thoughts and overcoming your fear. Remember that your thoughts are your reality. If you align your thoughts with the facts, then your reality is the same as mine. So the chances that your attitude to flying will move closer to mine. But here's an important point. What do you want to achieve? Do you recall what I said at the beginning? What is your desired outcome? Do you want to become an aerobatic pilot? Probably not. Do you want to fly with less anxiety than you do now? You certainly do. So here's another important message. Define your outcome clearly. Know what you want to achieve and how you want to feel about it, and aim towards reaching that situation. As I said before, if you define your goal too precisely, then you'll find it harder to achieve. Be realistic, but be challenging. Have a realizable goal. Don't make your jigsaw too big when you can get the same pleasure from a smaller one.